meeting of Parliament, Thursday the 20th of February 2020. We continue with answers to oral questions. We commence at question number 196, and the questioner is the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, referred to question 100 and 101 of 2020, can the Chief Minister confirm the sick leave rates for the civil service from 1st of November 2019 to the 1st of February 2020 and indicate the number of absent days arising from reporting 1, anxiety 2, depression 3, work-related stress and 4, any other mental health condition? Mr. Speaker, as already stated in answer to supplementary questions through questions 100 and 101 of 2020, the information is being compiled. It is expected that we will be publishing the information on a quarterly basis on the statistics section of the government website. I'm grateful to the Chief Minister, and no way was that question intended in any way to refocus the Chief Minister's mind on what he may wish to bring before this House. It was just to try to shorten the time gap to make it easier for civil servants to compile that information to be as useful as possible to this House is the question I'm asking. And I do appreciate very much the efforts that are being made to produce this material on a quarterly basis. Does the Chief Minister, given he has the detail at his fingertips, is he prepared to answer this question in relation to the breakdown in relation to those specific conditions that I've mentioned in this question? Because it would be helpful, rather than have a general response to the course of information, to have this is the answer to that type of question on inquiry, would it be broken down into further issues of physical and mental health?
Mr. Speaker, I think that the Honourable Gentleman has asked this question quite about the same issues, and therefore what I said we would compile would be the information in respect of these conditions and we would publish it. The Honourable Gentleman's question asked me once again to go back and obtain this information, but I thought I had made clear during the course of my earlier answer last month was that it was difficult to go back because that was an exercise of having to recompile across departments. As you appreciate, it's a quarter period and you're not going to go back, but still it's an exercise. And what I thought made sense, because the Honourable Gentleman has alighted upon a request for information that is not nonsensical, I think there is a value to having this information. We are compiling it now as we go, and therefore we will have the information at our fingertips once it is compiled on this basis. If other sorts of breakdowns are available, in other words, if instead of just giving anxiety, depression, work-related stress, any other mental health condition, it is also appreciable that there is a possibility of recording other conditions that give rise to absence in any meaningful way, for example, work-related injury, or you know, then it will be compiled in that way also. But I am awaiting information from the Office of the Chief Secretary, and indeed he will likely be consulting with the Statistics Office on how best to compile this information, apart from on the basis of the breakdown of the Honourable Gentleman has requested. But I can imagine that there may be a difficulty. For example, I should know of a certificate, we would have seen them as well in the course of the practice, anxiety and depression. Is that tab one or tab two? We may end up with more employees than we have medical certificates recorded, but if we are not careful to show that there is also a head of anxiety and depression. And therefore, I think how this all plays out is something we'll have more information on at the end of the first quarter. I would invite the Honourable Gentleman to ask us after the end of the first quarter, in the first meeting after April, so that we can then have a better view of how this information is being compiled, maintained, and published.
Question number 197, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Further to question 2020, can the government state the names of the non-medical consultants it or the DHA have engaged since the last general election?
The Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, as we have already provided for on the government website, the answer is set out in the schedule that I am now handing over. The names on the schedule had not yet been added to the website, and that's why they are on the schedule.
Question number 198, the Honourable D.J. Phillips.
If the Canada government updates this past on the completion date of the runway tunnel project.
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, it is not possible to provide a definitive date for the completion of the tunnel. Progress on the runway tunnel project has already been steady, with the civil work being well advanced and nearing completion. The next stage involves mechanical and electrical installation and is expected to commence within the next few months once the design packages are completed.
I could ask a question just for information. Is there a period within the next 24 months that the Chief Minister relates to so far as any potential possibility of a completion date? I very much appreciate what he's saying so far as the technical aspect of this project, but it is obviously one that causes a number of question marks all over the place. And so the member constituents of our community are very keen for this project to take place, and they've always in the past, and no doubt for all good reasons. But it would be, if the Chief Minister can be helpful in providing a period of time that it may need to take, and until the contract can be on board, the contract can be able to provide that information to.
Well, I don't necessarily agree that everyone in this house is looking forward to the runway tunnel opening. There are some who are concerned about the consequences of the runway tunnel opening. So I think the government agrees that this is a project that we now need, and we need the city to reach a conclusion so that the tunnel is open and this will help traffic flow in Gibraltar. That's why we have pursued it. So I can tell you, honourable gentlemen, that I said in the course of my New Year's address, on the second week of January, that I expect the runway to be open during the course of this calendar year. I think I want to remind the House that I said that in an earlier New Year's address. And I said it this year with the confidence that I had been given that it was very likely that this project would be completed. Now, honourable gentlemen will no doubt, honourable members will no doubt realise that this is not a delay of any making of the government in any way. The government has in litigation. Since we were elected with this particular contractor, we are pursuing through the government's advisors and professional consultants that the work done on the tunnel is done to the required standard. That is required that the government require that work be redone, and although there may be a period within work should be done, and you can therefore calculate when a project should be finished, if work is done in that foreseeable time frame, is then not of the standard and quality required, then the issue is do you accept it just because you want to hurry up, or do you take the advice of the professional advisors that the taxpayer is not getting the return for the amount being paid, and therefore it has to be redone, and therefore it was expected to take 6 weeks or so. And speaker, for that reason, although I remain confident that what I said at the beginning of the year, some 6 weeks ago, will still be something that we can expect to see materialize, namely that during the course of the calendar year, the tunnel will be open, it is not possible to say with any certainty, or any more certainty, that we will see the project come to fruition in that period. If we are to pursue it, I'm sure we all agree with the right approach, which is that the taxpayer should have a project completed to the standard and quality that the professional advisors of the government consider meet the standard and quality that British standards in our law require. For in particular, a project is technically challenging and important in this life.
Question number 199, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can we go to why who the landlord is for the premises rented by such Leanne's Place, and who are the beneficial owners of the landlord if it is a corporate vehicle?
I'm to the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the landlord for the premises rented by us at Leanne's Place is Ryhall Limited, R-Y-H-A-L-L Limited. The government understands that the ultimate beneficial owners of the company are the Peralta family, the Hassan family, the Levy family, and the Provostoli family. if you get the record to the Chief Counselor's answer, we didn't have the names of the individual members of the family who mentioned as being the beneficial owners. I don't see why I should speak. I think I've asked about the beneficial owners, and those beneficial owners have to be, I imagine, members as people rather than groupings, and therefore I think my question is entirely reasonable of the Chief Minister, unless this is keeping me inadmissible. But I think a question, a simple question is who is the beneficial owner? Is pretty clear. I get asked the Chief Minister, can you supply the name? He's wrong in speaking about political interests. Political interests can be held in trust for classes of people which do not have to be identified as individuals. And the speaker is, if we're going to be us, who are the beneficial owners and who are the Peralta family, who are the Hassan family, is the Honourable Gentleman going to require me to give him a family tree, because it's not information for which the government is responsible. I take the view that a government cannot deal with a corporate entity that is not a publicly listed entity without knowing who's behind it, because you know, the government could inadvertently fall into the trap of assisting in the laundering of funds if you are dealing with a company that is owned ultimately by somebody who is not fit and proper and who is not in legitimate business, then it would be wrong for the government to be doing that. So therefore, the government knows who it is dealing with. But whether we know that a great-grandchild, a grandchild, a daughter, a son, or any other has a particular share or not share in the ultimate beneficial ownership is really something quite difficult to require a government to come to this house to give. We know who we are dealing with, we know that these are the entities that hold the interests of those families. The interests of these families are held in absolutely proper structures which do not give you names of individuals. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is wrong about the premise of the question that ultimate beneficial ownership is held in names of individuals that government knows. We know who are the class of individuals that we're dealing with and the families that they represent. It's an answer that I've given him. I've been very forthright in giving him the answer when he's asked me. But I'm not a maintainer of family trees, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, just to be absolutely clear for the record, can the Chief Minister therefore confirm that he does not have the name of the ultimate beneficial owner of this land? Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that the Honourable Gentleman seems to misunderstand the concept of ultimate beneficial ownership. Can I ask you, the Chief Minister says that, and quite rightly, that when the government is in business, it needs to know who it's doing business with, and who satisfies us with people who are behind that proposition. So, that being the case, I think my Honourable colleague is just simply asking, who are these people? Well, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman has been told the family of, and I've said, the Peralta family, the Fenn family, the Levy family, and the Provision family. Now, the Honourable Gentleman knows who I'm talking about. These are families that are well known to him and well known to me. And he knows, Mr. Speaker, because he was a minister, as was Mr. Peter, that successive governments have held leases in that building through entities that have contractual arrangements with the government or that the government has shareholding, for example, Aquagen, Mr. Speaker, and he would therefore presumably have welcomed the attitude I have taken to ownership and dealing, have known who his government was in a contractual relationship with in that building. And so, Mr. Speaker, that hasn't changed. The issue is that there may be other children and the children of children, and if I am being asked to say exactly who the beneficial owners are, exactly who the beneficial owners are, Peter, that is to expect me to know the distribution that may have been in survivors of beneficial ownership in their family. And if I give an answer that is not absolutely precise, then I will be misleading the House, and it is not possible for the government to give an answer which is absolutely precise as to beneficial ownership, because Honourable Gentlemen will know that beneficial ownership moves without the register having to be updated. And so therefore, I may give an answer which may change in a moment, indeed in the moment I am giving the answer, because individuals may say, by the way, the quarter share that I have in this 25% of the business
I am no longer going to divide 10% for you and 10% for your sister. It's now going to be 15% for you and 5% for your sister. So benefit ownership changes in that way, and individual may be excluded from beneficial ownership or may be added to beneficial ownership. But no one is excluded because these are the families of these individuals. They are well known in Gibraltar. They own two particular immovable heredities that the Honourable Gentleman will be fully aware of, both of which are the subject of scrutiny in this House, although one of them in particular has been in the employ of government as an area where we have taken leases through three different administrations, one of which administrations included him and his Honourable and learned colleague across the way, without the ultimate beneficial ownership of those buildings changing as the families, or the breakup of ultimate beneficial ownership and split between those families may have been different at any time.
I see that. Well, first of all, certainly in the portfolio that I held when I was opposite on those benches, I certainly can recall ever having to deal with tenants of the unsleeps, so I'm not in a position to say that I don't hold any dealings with these tenants and the structures behind them. And Chief Minister, I certainly understand the Chief Minister's explanation, but I sense a degree of defensiveness in the answer, and I don't understand why. We are asking simply, he says he knows who he's dealing with, and it's simply asked, who is it that he's dealing with? Now, it can be one of two things that occur to the Honourable Chief Minister. It can either be because he used to know that he's dealing with those families that cannot specifically tell us who the beneficial owners are, ultimately, or he does know who the ultimate beneficial owners are, and somehow is reluctant to do it. Now, I understood his first answer to be more reluctant than his second. His second seems to be saying, if I can paraphrase it, that I used to know who the people are in the families, but I cannot specifically tell you what specific shares they are holding. That's how I understand his answer to be. Is it that my understanding is correct? Mm-hmm. Because the Honourable Gentleman seeks to impute to me an emotion that I don't feel. And I'm surprised that he thinks it's nothing to do so. I'm not feeling particularly defensive, because I don't think there's anything defensive about it. For us to have continued arrangements which were already in place when we were elected in 2011 would give rise to absolutely no need to feel defensive. We have added to those arrangements in respect of other arms of government would give absolutely no reason for defensiveness. What we might sense, Mr. Speaker, is exasperation and having to have the same debate house after house. Because frankly, there's a lot much better to be getting on with, not just in this life, but in the context of the things that the community requires us to be doing. So look, one is here to answer their question. When dealing with ultimate beneficial ownership, Mr. Speaker, there is no register at the moment. There will be a register in the future. The Honourable Gentleman knows that the fifth anti-money laundering directive requires that there should be a register of ultimate beneficial owners. But it does not require, because the fifth anti-money laundering directive does not require it, that the trust should be reflected. Now, with these families that the Honourable Gentleman should be aware of, and I'm surprised that he was so siloed in respect of his responsibilities when he was elected that he didn't know any of what else was happening with his government, because he didn't know or ask or seek to inquire about the fact that Aftergift held lease at last year. He wasn't aware of it. And he didn't really pay for his utilities in the old days with textbooks. He was able to do it all by direct debit. I think you know that the government owns a one-third share in property, as you put on money, or that the government has a contractual relationship with Land Property Services Limited, Mr. Speaker, and that they are tenants in this same building, and that there are arrangements in respect of cost in the business. So to be at the defensiveness is as nothing in the context of the emotion that I feel at the moment. But I do feel that there's continual frustration at not being asked to address some of the key issues that confront the community instead of being asked to extend to intimate particulars as to the family structures that people may have established to own their property. But we speak up despite that, if they want the information, I've told them, the government feels it must know who it's dealing with, and the government does know who it's dealing with. It's dealing with the Peralta family, the Rafan family, the Levy family, the Provostoli family. We do not know, Mr. Speaker, with any level of precision, because it is not possible to know with any level of accuracy, because beneficial ownership can change at any time, who the exact beneficial owners in those families are. But what I know of these families is all of whom I have long-standing personal relationships. I can tell him who the controlling mind of the Peralta family has been. I can tell him who the controlling mind of the Hassan family has been. I can tell him who the controlling mind of the Levy family is, of course, and of the Provostoli family. But that doesn't mean that that's the ultimate benefit for them, Mr. Speaker, because they have set up structures to establish their family holdings for their families in different ways, which are private, etc. And so, I cannot give him that level of family detail. Neither do I think, Mr. Speaker, the government is answerable for how a family has set up its beneficial ownership of a structure. But, Speaker, I'm in your hands if you wish me to explore further the family trees of these established and important trading families in Gibraltar. Speaker, if that last answer does not redefine and take to new levels the meaning of the word defensiveness, I don't know what it is. The honourable member has said he thinks that government should know who it's dealing with, and that in fact he does know. I would have thought that it would be an intrinsic part of that exercise simply to ask the people who you are dealing with who the ultimate benefits of the government are. I don't think that is an unreasonable request, and it's maybe right for them, the government, to answer questions put by opposition members on the basis of who it's dealing with, that it doesn't know who they are. I think it's entirely reasonable. It's not that the government is answerable as to how families are structuring their business. They can structure their business however they want. The point is that if the government enters into contracts, this house, that house, or another house, with whoever it is, it should know who it's dealing with, point one, which the people must accept, and not only should it know who it's dealing with, it should then make that information public if it's asked in this house. It's not an unreasonable request. And I can jive all day as to what I knew when I was on that side of the house, but as the minister responsible for health or for the environment, did I ask every single colleague minister what individual dealings they were handling for the government? Well, I obviously had some visibility, but did I have visibility of every single contract? No. That's not the point. Let's not sidestep the issue. What we're asking about is today, and it's a perfectly reasonable question that my honourable colleague has put, which I re-put to the Chief Minister. If you know who the ultimate beneficial owners are, then we are asking him who those people are. If he does not know, because he knows mostly who the families are, but he does cannot tell us the ultimate beneficial owners because the government has not asked, that's the other answer. Well, Mr. Speaker, I suppose that given the honourable members have got themselves up of a creek, they are going to continue to seek to paddle their way out of it. So I'm going to try and be explicit in a way that even they should be able to understand. The government that I lead has taken the view that if we deal with a corporate entity, we are not satisfied simply if there is on the register not an individual to have a relationship with a corporate entity owned by a corporate entity, we want to know who's really behind it. We know who is really behind the entities that are the owners of the floors at the Arms Place, which is what this property is, and who we are dealing with. We have known, not just, Mr. Speaker, in relation to Hall Limited, but also in relation to the leases that Applegate have acquired, where the government owns one third of the interest, and the leases that have been acquired by LPS, who are the government's property agent. Those relationships go back for some time. The point I'm making to the Honourable Gentleman is not to guide, it's just to remind him. But he is so defensive, so he takes every reminder as a guide.
Okay.
Now, what has not changed are the families that own the buildings that give rise to the leases. Those families, Mr. Speaker, are the families I have referred him to. The ultimate beneficial ownership down to individuals is not something the government requires to know who we are dealing with beneficially. We know that we're dealing with those families. We don't know the shareholding between those families, and we don't know whether anybody has been excluded in the context of those families or included in the context of those families. For that reason, Mr. Speaker, short of standing here and reading them out, the family trees of each of those families, it is not possible to give them information, and in any event, the government is not answerable for how the beneficial ownership is distributed at any time in those family interests. And indeed, it could change at any time, because at the moment, that ultimate beneficial ownership is not registrable. Now, I hope I've explained it clearly enough that the Honourable Gentleman has understood, and that even in his attempt to make mischief, he will not be able to pretend that I have avoided explaining who we are dealing with. People would actually quite like me to go through the family trees of those families, or at least those that I am aware of. I'm quite happy at the next meeting of the House, despite having many other better things to do, to ask one of the established family tree providers in Gibraltar, in conjunction with these families, to provide me with the data so I can read the names out here. Is that, Mr. Speaker, as you said, the locally wrote this book?
One more question, Mr. Speaker.
Well, I think the House of my colleague, I think we will take you up on that offer, so please do.
Mr. Speaker, one simple question which I'm sure the Chief Minister is in a position to answer. It refers to the Baralta family, the Sam family, the Lee family, and the Popatori family as being the beneficial owners. Can you confirm to the House that these are the same families and bring an answer to question 85 as being the beneficial owners of this court limited? That held the lease on the previous officers, which the government law officers have recently moved into. Can the Chief Minister confirm that we are indeed talking about the same family?
Well, Mr. Speaker, of course I can. I can confirm that these are the same families, but I cannot confirm on my feet, Mr. Speaker, that families that own the interest in all the other hereditaments in Gibraltar where the government may hold leases, which don't appear to hold any interest for honourable gentlemen on the opposite benches. They seem to have, well, they seem to have, Mr. Speaker, an unhealthy obsession with these four families, which doesn't afflict his requirement for information in respect of any other families that might have business dealings with the government. But that's a matter entirely for him, I suppose.
Question number 200, the Honourable Alan Kenton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise if it has entered, or if it has entered, or contemplating entering into a lease agreement with Gift Corp Limited for the 4th and 5th floors of NatWest House?
I'm the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government is not presently considering any lease or other arrangements in respect of the 4th or 5th floors of NatWest House, but does not discard doing so in the future, and the same is true of other buildings in and around Gibraltar.
Question number 201, the Honourable Alan Kenton.
Mr. Speaker, can we come to advise if the Chief Secretary is made aware of obvious conflicts of interest by Mr. McGowan and Mr. McGowan's ministers
Mr. Mayo's capacity as Vice Secretary, in demonstrating the English records in the network for investing using them and all other individual partners, public affairs and personal liability for rental payments and non expired portion of the West Side Police and District Court.
I'm sorry, all of the key points here.
The Chief Secretary was to advise. Although, as I've already informed the House, none of Mr. Ricordi, Mr. Lena, or myself, or indeed Mr. Peter, as far as I know, have had anything to do with the idea, negotiation, or agreement of the lease at NatWest House for the Office of the Director of Public Prosecution. Despite that, and although the idea, negotiation, and agreement regularly were aroused from any conflict of interest, the Chief Secretary was made aware that it was not impossible that some foolish and utterly twisted mind might seek to pervert the honest and objective reality of utter propriety for potential self-serving political mischief. The Chief Secretary was therefore fully aware of the issue when he assessed the arrangement and signed the lease. Speaker, what sort of directions did the Chief Minister or his Secretary give in respect to such a commercial transaction? Mr. Speaker, the word "collusion" suggests that something has been done which is improper. And if the Honourable Gentleman is going to make that allegation, I'd ask him to do so by motion and to particularise why he said there was such a pernicious relevant motive.
The Honourable Member prepared to put forward his view in writing as to why he has suggested question number 202.
Can the Chief Minister help us with why his name was on the lease when the lease was placed in 2016?
Mr. Speaker, because as the Honourable Gentleman knows, and as declared in my register of members' interest, that I hold interest in respect of the firm of which I am on sabbatical. And therefore, when the firm enters into obligations, it requires all of its partners, even those who are on sabbatical, to enter into those obligations. It wasn't just my name that was on the list. The name of the founder of the GFP was on the list. The name of Mr. Julian and Mr. Peter were on the list. The signing leases has never been considered to be pernicious.
Mr. Speaker, I was just trying to clarify that because this is a lease that I understand it was 2016. It's been taken over and had a sort of term. The term did not expire. In fact, it's not due to expire until sometime next year. It was my understanding of the lease that has been brought to my attention. I certainly wasn't aware because I haven't been checking this declaration of interest. But the Chief Minister did indicate, I think in the last time this a similar question was on the order paper, and I note that today he said quite pointedly, I think, that none of them, meaning yourself, Mr. Ricordi or Mr. Lena, had, I think I took their notes accurately, had anything to do with the idea, negotiation or agreement. And in fact, I think last time that there was some supplementary that I put on the issue, he first explained that the idea did not come from him, but that the idea came from the Attorney General one day who met him and said, wouldn't it be a good idea? That there was some kind of exchange by which the Attorney General then thereafter went off to negotiate the terms with the DPP on the building. My question is this, though.
advised the executive, and therefore thought that it might be that someone might fall in view of that situation. When the Attorney General came to him with the idea, rather than stating him, well, okay, go off with it, you can go and negotiate the deal, why didn't the Chief Minister rather say, well, you know what, Michael, actually, we should not be interested in negotiating something like that because the name of the Finance Secretary, my name, and another minister is on the list, and it just simply won't look good. Why wasn't that the reaction of the Chief Minister?
Well, Mr. Speaker, you see, whether something stands the test of electricity, whether something is in substance right or wrong, whether there is a conflict of interest or not, is not about perception, it is about substance. And indeed, looking objectively at what happened in this case, and not simply taking the characterizations that the honourable member opposite might like to put in it, standing aside from something that involves you and allowing others to consider whether it should happen or not is what is required when there is a conflict of interest. And if you get in a situation where the decision is not led or indeed initiated by the person who may be said to have a conflict of interest, because if you pick up, it's not as if I didn't imagine that these exchanges would arise. There is nothing that has been done here in secret. Everything has been done in the open. We are talking about things which are entirely registrable. In other words, notice is given to the world of these arrangements. And the view of the Director of Public Prosecutions and the Attorney General was that there was nowhere else within walking distance of the court which they considered apt for the needs that they had. And so the conflict that they had, Mr. Speaker, is that they tell us on the one hand that they want us to find offices for civil servants which are fit and proper for them to do their work. And then, when those offices are found, they try and drill down to some reason they may find to suggest that something doesn't look right. Well, Mr. Speaker, look, conflicts of interest arise in every community in the world. They would, of course, in particular, arise in the context of a community of our size. And it is not that where there is a conflict of interest that cannot be dealing, it's that where there is a conflict of interest, it is important, or indeed a potential conflict of interest, it is important to highlight that and ensure it is dealt with properly. I am satisfied that this was dealt with entirely properly because I immediately alerted the Chief Secretary to the possibility through the Attorney General, distanced myself and the Financial Secretary from the negotiation and the possibility that it may happen, indicated that I thought that there might be a debate of this sort later in the House, and ensured that all decisions were made at arm's length. Therefore, honourable gentlemen can cry from the rooftops about what they would like people to think about the transaction, but the reality and substance of the transaction, and the council they will know that it is substance that matters, was absolutely and entirely proper, and I'm delighted to have it subject to the scrutiny of this community. And Mr. Speaker, frankly, I think that the deal that was done was one that was in the interest of the Director of Public Prosecution, because he put it and pursued it, one which we have been supporting the Attorney General on, and on which those who have alleged in the public interest had absolutely no influence whatsoever, thereby removing the potential conflict of any negative effect. Mr. Speaker, doesn't the Chief Minister agree that it's not just substance, it's substance and perception? Because the conflict of interest issue is not just an issue of substance. Of course, the substance is important. And in substance, there might not be the conflict of interest. But it is also perception. And perception matters, especially in a small community where it may not look right. Look, Mr. Speaker, I'm staring at the draft ministerial code which honourable members opposite produced, which emphasises the point that it's not just about substance, that it's about substance or perception. Ministers must ensure
or perceived conflict of interest between their ministerial position and their private financial interest. Actual substance perceived with perception matters. Where it's decided that a minister can retain an interest, the minister and department must put processes in place to prohibit access to certain papers and ensure that the minister is not involved in certain decisions and discussions relating to that interest. And so, perception matters. And I repeat the question, because there was a release dated 2016 that expired in midway in 2021. The fact that the Attorney General's chambers was moving to that building made the tenant of that building surrender their lease early and therefore get out of the liability of 18 months hence. There is an obvious interest there. There's a negative distinction between substance and perception. And I'm saying to the Honourable Member, would it not, on reflection, have been the right thing to do to avoid this whole debate and rather say to the Attorney General, you've written this issue, it's come from you, not from me, but I have to tell you that there will be a perceived conflict of interest and it is not in the interest of anyone for this to go further. Of course I don't agree with him, because I told the Attorney General the opposite of what he said. I told the Attorney General that despite the fact that I knew that it was likely that there would be such a debate in the future, if it was the right thing to do, we should pursue it without my involvement. And without the involvement of Mr. Bennett, or people that don't have any awareness whatsoever. And so you see, what he hasn't understood, Mr. Speaker, is that it is exactly for that reason that I made clear that we would not be involved in the negotiation or discussion of the lease. Because there would otherwise have been a perceived conflict of interest. But because we were not, it is only in the context of being attempting to twist and pervert reality that a perception may so arise. Is it that the Honourable Gentleman is saying that it is fine for other parties of the House to have the benefit of being released from the 18-month obligation, but not for others? As long as you're not in executive control of the decision-making, you're not in control of the driving seat of the negotiation, there can be no conflict of interest which arises actually or in substance after that point. In other words, once you take yourself out of the executive decision making, and you are left those who will be involved in the executive decision making of what your potential interest would be, that's it. Of course, you can say it, which is what the Honourable Gentleman is doing. He's just trying to spin it to try to cast an expression. So, what does it do? You could spin it in. You could spin somebody being a consultant or a sabbatical from a law firm 15 years ago on issues relating to the island that's been working, but then materialized in a way that others have said was not entirely proper under the standards of electricity. You could spin conceding liability on a claim on a right to right, which appears to have been done in a way that is not at arm's length because of interests and relationships between people. Even if it were done in exactly the right way, because perception can be done, which is what the Honourable Gentleman said to you. The Honourable Gentleman is just trying to suggest that we have done something to get for ourselves the benefit, when in fact, despite the fact that we knew that it would cause us political grief, because those who were suggesting it should be done thought it was proper, we put ourselves apart from it, and allow the political grief to happen because it was the right thing to do for the community and for those who, if were in the view of the DPP and the Attorney General, would be better housed in that place than any other. So, Mr. Speaker, we can keep going around the houses in this part of the right. I know that he wants to continue going around the houses. I know that he wants to find a reason to ask me another question, because he wants to keep talking about this, because talking about this is what he thinks he's going to try, is going to garner him some element of support that he cannot otherwise garner for himself. That's fine. To an extent, I understand the family politics the way that they do it. But it doesn't change the fact that we were very careful to ensure that there couldn't even be the perception of that conflict by setting ourselves apart the moment that we were told about it. That's the proper way to deal with things. It is the way that we have dealt with it. And, Mr. Speaker, I am frankly not surprised that they're trying to do it in another way. Mr. Speaker, I am not in the perception of reaction. I think that I have said, I believe, is a twist or unreacting. I said, I've asked him questions about a lease which, in fact, is dated to 2016 on which he is on. I've asked him questions because that lease was due to expire midway in 2021. That is also a fact. It is also a fact that by the Attorney General's chamber getting into that property, it made the tenant of that property give up early, therefore saving 18 months rent. And he was on that document. And therefore there is a perceived and actual conflict of interest. And he talked about what processes he put in place. But I ask him, he's the finance minister as well. When it came to the crunch and the negotiations of the DPP and Attorney General were at an end, someone had to sanction the deal because the Attorney General was the finance minister and the DPP was the finance minister. Someone had to sanction the deal. And he is compromised. The financial secretary is compromised and his name is on the deed as well. And then takes the decision at arm's length. Who then takes the decision of answer to make sure that there is no perceived conflict of interest? That's the point, Mr. Speaker. So who in fact did take the final decision? I see, Mr. Speaker, in an attempt to say that he is not doing what I suggested he was doing, just for the sake of filling them, he has gone up, said he's not doing it, and gone on to repeat everything just for the sake of repeating it. So, let us just be clear about this, Mr. Speaker. I have absolutely no compunction in the Honourable Gentleman repeating what he has said as many times as he likes, because I believe that the transaction that he is trying to impugn is one which is absolutely and perfectly proper, and that it was dealt with absolutely and perfectly properly, not just in keeping with the existing rules, but in keeping with the rules as we would have them be, so the ones that we apply to ourselves in respect of conflict of interest. Now, he says, who made the final decision, therefore? If you set yourself apart and the financial secretary sets himself apart, and you are the finance minister, who made the final decision? Well, Mr. Speaker, we delegated that power to make that final decision, as I have already explained to him, but I can spell out once again, to three people, the probity of which is very much in question, given the things that he has said, obviously. To the Attorney General, to the Director of Public Prosecutions, and to the Chief Secretary. Now, you will recall from the time that he was a minister, that agreements were entered into, not by politicians, but by members of the administration, principally the Chief Secretary. If I were to say, in respect of any other transaction, forget this one, that I have made the decision, then that might vitiate the signature on the document by the Chief Secretary. Because the Chief Secretary is the person who signs, is the person who has to make the final decision. Because if the person who signs and binds has not made the decision, we impugn the decision in that way. So Mr. Speaker, we have this answer. They've had this answer for some time. They're not interested in the answer that the Attorney General, who as we will know in law is considered to be the fountain of justice, the Director of Public Prosecutions, who as we will know is the person who has been delegated to the Attorney General as the person to make decisions about prosecutions, and the Chief Secretary, are the people who made that decision. How could they not have known? I've given them the answer before, and the Chief Secretary as to the Attorney General and Director of Public Prosecutions, and the Chief Secretary is the person who found the document. Now, he can pretend as much as he likes. What's going on is obvious. He is trying to pass this question. His sidekick was not able to do it as effectively as he thinks he can. He's got up to try and spell it out.
every time I sit down, he's going to get up again to throw it out again in the hope that it's going to somehow cross more bugs that will, in some way, deprive me of personal support in the community and somehow drive that support to him. We can play this game with someone right. And if he likes, we can play it going all the way back to when he was the minister and the things that happened at Queen's Bridge on the island. It's up to him for other things that happened when he was the minister.
Can I ask you just to make this assignment and then something that you can think of? The
honourable member is the doesn't want to prolong this, he's not going round the houses himself. I mean, he not only goes round the houses, I mean, he'll need a map to get out of the maze he gets into sometimes. Speaker, I certainly cannot recall that he has felt how he took the financial visit. I know that he has said before. He negotiated once he had that meeting with the Attorney General and he sent him off. I know he said that before, but I cannot recall that he has expressed in detail this delegation to this triumvirate of officials. We are not casting aspersions about, by the way. We are simply trying to understand how they dealt with the actual and perceived conflict of interest, which clearly arose in this case. Now, can I ask the Chief Minister, given that they put in place this delegation, was this delegation orally communicated, or was there a delegation in writing explaining the purpose of it? Mr. Speaker, it's remarkable that the minute that somebody puts it to honourable members on the other side, that they are casting a question, despite the fact that they may have spent the past 20 minutes casting a question, they immediately recoil from that. If they want to cast aspersions, they should have the government to cast aspersions and say that they're casting aspersions, because that is what they're doing. Again, if they recall the distinction between form and substance, because if they get up and they say, in effect, well, this is all, you know, they're saying, a transaction born from conflict and is designed to relieve the liability of those who were signatories to the 2016 lease, they get up and say it. They know they can't, because that is not what happened. But they try to seek to create the suggestion that that's what was happening. And I'm reminded of the debate that they were having with House, because it did great damage to the reputation of people in 1995, when the perception of corruption was raised, and people didn't have the gumption to talk about corruption. They talked about the perception of corruption, and in that way, they ruined the reputation of many people. Well, Mr. Speaker, if all of the members want to cast aspersions, they should have their gumption to tell us that we have acted improperly, and then defend why they say that we've acted improperly. We have acted entirely properly. In the interest of the civil servants who required to be moved from where they were, and in the interest of the taxpayer, we have divorced ourselves from decision making. We have ensured that we have delegated the negotiation and conclusion of these matters to others. We have done that orally, not in writing. I can't confirm to him whether there has been an email on this or whether there was just a conversation. If there was a conversation, I cannot confirm to him whether there was or there was not a note. But it was all done entirely properly. But Mr. Speaker, I wonder whether other governments can say that they did things entirely properly in the past. I wonder whether if we look into files in the past, we might not find all sorts of things which I'm not even going to venture to mention at the stage, because actually it would be better for them to simply withdraw any suggestion of impropriety if that's what they are intending to do. Not to cast any further aspersions aggressively or inadvertently, and not to put this community into a hole of mudslinging when we least need to do that. We need to be looking out to the challenges that we face. And of course, that people go to work, in particular in this government, and I'm sure in others from his point of view, to do their best for the community every day, and not to look out for their pocket or to look out for their liabilities and their leads that might have been entered into in respect of other responsibilities that one may hold. But if they want to see the world in a different way, it doesn't do anything other than belittle them.
Question number 202, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker. I think the government's provided details of the fees payable to James Stockton in respect of the Aretha transaction.
I'm afraid one of the two things.
Mr. Speaker, one of the two or three.
Question number 203, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Speaker, for the question 100% of 2020, can the government identify the financial advisors who are receiving fees of £2,500 per pound a month, and what services are they providing to whom?
And for the Honourable the Chief Minister.
The Aruka transaction involved a number of entities not owned, controlled, or managed by the government. And as such, the government is not able to provide details of the transaction as a whole in respect of James Stockton Co. or any other entity. I can tell him that the annual return of fees to act as a financial advisor for GIC Limited is payable to James Stock and is £2,500 per month.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the Chief Minister's answer. Can you advise, given that the Aruka transaction is closed, what further services is James Stockton still providing that requires this monthly retainer?
Mr. Speaker, I'm interpreting the notes I've been given correctly as a process service agent.
My reflection of the function of the process service agent may be a bit dusty. But would the Chief Minister confirm in that, or be able to confirm that the process service agent merely acts as a post box in respect to any legal agreement, in respect of any potential disputes on the various agreements, and they are served on James Stockton Co. Presumably, they have an address in London. And for that, they're charging £2,500 a month, which, to be honest, I think seems a bit excessive.
I don't know whether it's excessive or not because I don't know what process service agents charge in London. But I told them in the course of the first answer that we also have financial advisors, and then I've added as process service agents.
My very last comment on this. The financial advisors, as I said earlier, the transaction, as far as I'm aware, is closed. Unless the Chief Minister says there could be more transactions in the future on this structure, in which case they are being retained. Does the Chief Minister have any knowledge on this, or is it that this is information that is privy to the companies within the structure?
No, Mr. Speaker, it doesn't mean any of that. It means that they provide some advisory service and they provide process agent services. That doesn't mean that there can be other transactions in respect to the structure, although we've already alerted the whole of the community that there can be further transactions of this sort to fund future affordable housing. But I don't know what it is that they do as financial services, financial advisors to GIC and as process service agents, Mr. Speaker. Try and conject as much as you like about that, but without looking at the documents themselves and seeing what their duties are, we would not be able to reach a final conclusion.
Question number 204, the Honourable Alan Kenton.
Speaker, can you advise how it is envisaged that GIC Limited will make a profit on the repurchase of government affordable housing interest? The group will bought for £88.5 million in GRP at book value.
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the interest purchased by GIC Limited grows every year at 7%, which will create a profit for GIC Limited, rising at that rate per annum.
Mr. Speaker, can you please explain what it means by the housing interest? Is that the rate at which homeowners have to buy their interest in that it is increasing at 7% per annum according to the regional purchase agreement. Is that correct? At which point, in future, GIC would be making a profit compared to the book value of water. Is that what you're going to say? Is that there's a contractual agreement with the own purchasers that their participant, the government owner, goes up by 10% each year indefinitely? Mr. Speaker, I haven't said the word housing interest. One of the gentlemen said housing interest, I said interest. There are no home purchases here. The home purchases are people who buy these properties as their home, not those who invest in the equity of 50-50. But yes, the agreement is that the growth rate is 7% per annum. And there's a reason for that, Mr. Speaker. Since affordable housing was introduced in this community in the late 1980s, the leases provide for growth at 7% per annum, reaching market value at the time that the individual may wish to buy the residual 50% interest, or that other interest may not have bought at the time of original purchase. Subsequently, the Land Management Committee of successive administrations has simply applied a 7% uplift to the price to reach the sale price rather than have an assessment of market value. The reason for that is because we have no competing interest in determining what market value might be at any particular time. And so this is the way it has been done since the first equity purchases in 1990, I think, and when purchasers then came back to government to take their interest, even after the period that was prescribed for in the lease, was the 70% growth. I think it was 70% growth for 7 years that was provided for in the lease. But that will continue to be applied by successive governments going forward.
Question number 205, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please provide a schedule with an analysis showing how the £25 million contribution to the recurrent expenditure of government-owned companies has been allocated by company name for each of the following financial years ended 31st of March, being 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, and 2019.
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Speaker, we'll answer with 206.
Question number 206, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please provide a schedule or analysis showing how the £13 million contribution to the recurrent expenditure of government-owned companies is anticipated to be allocated by company name for financial year ended 31st of March 2020?
And for the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. The contribution has been as follows. For the year ended March 2015, £25 million to Gibraltar Investment Holdings Limited. For the year ended March 2016, £25 million to Gibraltar Investment Holdings Limited. For the year ended March 2017, £25 million to Gibraltar Investment Holdings Limited. For the year ended March 2018, £25 million to Gibraltar Investment Holdings Limited. For the year ended March 2019, £35 million to Gibraltar Investment Holdings Limited. Speaker, the government is not able to provide a schedule of the allocation of the £30 million contribution to the recurrent expenditure of government-owned companies for the financial year ended the 31st of March 2020, simply because the financial year ended the 31st of March 2020 has simply not yet ended, as the 31st of March 2020 has simply not yet come.
Question number 207, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Mr. Speaker, does the government intend to review the law relating to the liability of the state to make redundancy payments to directors of insolvent companies out of the insolvency fund?
Answer the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Mr. Speaker, I'm very pleased to see the Honourable Gentleman back among us on the American Bureau of Justice. If you think that there is no liability of the state to make redundancy payments to directors of insolvent companies after the insolvency fund, then there is therefore nothing to review in this respect. In fact, I had somebody look at this before I asked it, and I looked at it myself, and the interpretation was that a director can be an employee of a company, and therefore, as an employee acquires the name of the company, they can then make a claim on the insolvency fund. Now, I know this happened in relation to, I think it was Siemens at the time, some time ago, when that company also went into liquidation. And I recall there were questions actually that were raised by the owner of the father of the house in relation to this at the time. So, unless this has been reformed, and I'm aware of it, the law continues to be what it has, but no doubt the organization will put me right in relation to that. Well, Mr. Speaker, the advice I have, of course, as to what he says at the end of the following house, when he said, he knows that with a very great affection, I don't take anything that he says at face value and would have to check what it was that was actually said at the time. But the advice that I have, which has been set out very clearly and I'm happy to share with him, relates to Regulation 2 of the Gibraltar Development Corporation Employers Insolvency Regulations of 1991, which reads as follows. I'm not able to tell him that this is amended at any particular time to the regulation as it stands. Regulation 2 defines worker as meaning an individual engaged by an employer under a contract to which the employment regulations of 1994 apply. Whether that contract is written or oral, expressly implied, and the articles of apprenticeship or any other training scheme are included, and that contract, whether written or oral, including in terms of apprenticeship, was entered into Gibraltar for employment either wholly in part in Gibraltar or elsewhere in the European Union, or outside Gibraltar for employment in Gibraltar, provided that these regulations shall not apply where the employer is a company to an individual who is a director of that company. So, for that reason, I think it's pretty clear that there is no application of the sort of gentleman to use it.
Question number 208, the Honourable Joseph Barry.
Speaker, when will legislation in respect of the tax policy is going to be introduced to Parliament?
The Honourable Chief Minister.
Speaker, without those questions, together with questions 209 to 211.
Question number 209, the Honourable Joseph Barry.
Mr. Speaker, how can the Chief Minister reconcile what he says about the tax policy thing with what the Spanish government says it does and the actual effects it has?
Question number 210, the Honourable Chair for Parliament.
Mr. Speaker, has the Chief Minister seen the questions by the Spanish Foreign Affairs Ministry on the meeting held in Madrid on the 23rd of January 2020 in respect of the MOUs to Spain's affecting Gibraltar?
Question number 211, the Honourable Chair for
Parliament. Mr. Speaker, does the government think we should seek future arrangements by which Gibraltar would form part of a common travel area with a Schengen zone and have this been formally or informally tabled in intergovernmental discussions or with the UK?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the bill to give effect to the tax treaty which we may enter into with any particular nation has been published today in the Gibraltar Gazette. Mr. Speaker, I am only answerable in this House for what the government of Gibraltar says or does. I'm surprised the Honourable Leader of the Opposition thinks that the Chief Minister of Gibraltar should be answerable here for what the Spanish government says or does for their interpretation of this. I have seen, of course, the press release of the Spanish Foreign Affairs Ministry on the meeting in Madrid on the 23rd of January 2020 with respect to the MOU. I don't know if the Honourable Member has seen the press release on the National Cabinet of Gibraltar the same day. I have no doubt, Mr. Speaker, he will regard our government's statement as a more reliable source of information.
As I said publicly, the government is examining various options for the establishment of a regime that will ensure Pontus unity at the end of the conditional period, set out in the withdrawal agreement. As I said publicly also, such options include the establishment of a travel area with the Schengen area. I just think that those four rolled up questions span quite a lot, so I have a number of supplementaries that I know, and I'll take it in stages. Yes, we got a few minutes before obviously arriving at the house, we invited that the legislation had just been published, so we will take our time to respect that legislation in due course. I'm not suggesting to the Honourable Member, in respect of the Constitution, that I think that he is answerable for what the Spanish government is. I'm not suggesting that at all. He is, of course, answerable for what he says, and does, and that is really what we are proving today. But it seems to us quite markedly different and prominent, indeed, that the Spanish Foreign Secretary recently, who has made comments that, some comments that a member's opposite and indeed the Deputy Chief Minister has said are constructive, but the members opposite have also made the distinction that they do not agree with some things that he has said. The Foreign Secretary of Spain made it clear in an article in the Financial Times that was then reported locally that he thought that the tax treaty was important for sovereignty. Now, does the Chief Minister agree with the Spanish Foreign Secretary that that is the effect of the tax treaty? Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Honourable Member for having clarified what it is that he's asking me about. He's now saying he is not asking me to interpret what or to become answerable for what it is that the Spanish government has said. He's asking me only to reflect on the things that we have said and the interplay between that and what it is that the Spanish government has said. So, always, because that I do appreciate. But in particular, which of the things that the Spanish government has said is it that he is trying to get me to address? Is it the things that he might agree with us are constructive, or is it their perception of why they have done a particular arrangement? Because if that is the case, he might want to juxtapose the position of one minister with the position of another. One foreign minister with a position of a former foreign minister. I don't know whether he has seen the exchanges that the current Spanish foreign minister has had today with the former Spanish foreign minister, Señor Margallo, about the statements that he made. Because Señor Margallo has taken issue with what Señora González Laya has said, telling her that she must not give up sovereignty in the way that they are saying that she has. So, although he might like me to comment only and dryly on what González Laya said in the Financial Times and the interpretation that some have given to it, I would ask him to look at the very negative perception that has been put in Spain on what Señora González Laya has said by her second immediate predecessor, Señor Margallo. And to speak up, look, we are very clear. Tax treaty has not ceded one iota of sovereignty. I say we because I am the leader of government business in Gibraltar. But the Honourable former Chief Minister, Joe Botano, long known as the hawks on the issue of sovereignty, has said the same thing. And my immediate predecessor, who won four elections on the trot for the BOC, has said that from a legal point of view, he's seen no reason to believe there's a concession of sovereignty, and that from a political view, he had perceived the slight concession of sovereignty, he would have spoken up immediately. So, I would comment on what my predecessors have said, and
suggests that they are in keeping and in the same view that I have taken and that my government has taken and that my cabinet has taken. But, Mr. Speaker, if you were going to do the exercise of seeking to reconcile what is said by a Spanish minister with what is said by a Gibraltar minister, I mean, can we reconcile what the Spanish foreign minister at the time said about the Cordoba arrangements and about the trilateral process with what his former leader said about the Cordoba arrangements and the trilateral arrangements? Because, you know, in the same room, people seem to be speaking the same language. The minute they went outside and spoke to different newspapers, they seem to have been in different rooms speaking different languages. Perhaps this is because that is the nature of diplomacy. But as far as I'm concerned, everything that we have said in Gibraltar about the tax treaty, on which I am backed by the former chief minister and by the former chief minister, both of whom have expressed their view about sovereignty. I think it's very clear, Mr. Speaker, that there's absolutely no question of the international tax treaty between Gibraltar and Spain being anything that could be characterized as a session on sovereignty. But you could say, Mr. Speaker, you could say that these days, for some, it is more important to reach arrangements that are practical than to simply pursue ephemeral concepts. And if that is what I would tell us why I was saying, then I would add that to the list of what I consider to be positive and constructive. If he was saying something else, then I might not consider that to be part of what I consider to be positive and constructive. But then what matters here is the substance of the treaty, which, as he knows, which has a completely different view on to him, and it's not just it's the former successful leader of his current party that takes the same view as us at a political level. He's now clarifying at a legal level. And the former leader of my party, the founder of the GSOP, the fourth, as the Daniel takes that view, you know what, Mr. Speaker, I am entirely comfortable in the view that I'm taking. Oh, I'm sure that we will prove that we will get to detail another day. Mr. Speaker, when the, I think the Honourable Member talked about Cordoba, and but at Cordoba, of course, there was probably less scope for disagreement because there was a joint communique between the Foreign Secretary of Australia and indeed the Chief Minister then, because indeed it was a trilateral process. So, anyway, that's where. I think that is an important distinction. Can I ask on the question on the press release by the Spanish Foreign Ministry on the 23rd of January, unless I indeed did see it, but if he has seen the press release of the Spanish Foreign Ministry, he will have been struck, like I was struck, admittedly, by the tone of bilateralism that the response had, with which I expect he does not agree. And can I ask him whether he was similarly struck by that, and that can he assure the House that in continuing to engage with the government of Spain and indeed the United Kingdom as we go forward, that he will be careful to ensure that the arrangements are preserved, so that we have a separate and distinct role in those negotiations. Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm surprised that you praise the name of the Cordoba Agreement. I was, of course, going to mention them, as I did in my earlier intervention, because it was clear that they were relevant in the context of this debate. But the Cordoba Arrangements were not agreed, as we found the moment that a different government was elected in Spain. What had been sold here as agreement turned out to be political statements, we were told, which did not bear signature and which were therefore not enforceable. And so he was wrong, Mr. Speaker, to say that those were in any way comparable to the arrangements today, because the arrangements today are agreements. And there are two agreements, Mr. Speaker. It's important that we bear this in mind. Both when he goes back to read the very disparaging things that he said about the trilateral process and the Cordoba agreements
when he wasn't in the party that he is in now, he was leading another party that has failed to lead to success. And when he analyzes these agreements, because he's actually right, the Spanish statement, it is just a statement, reading the way that the Spanish were drafted to allege a bilateralism that isn't there. Why is there no bilateralism there of the sort that they allege? For a simple reason. These are not agreements between the United Kingdom and Spain that can be characterized bilaterally in the way the Spanish have attempted to do. The withdrawal agreement is indeed a bilateral agreement. A bilateral agreement between the United Kingdom and the European Union. And the United Kingdom, for the purposes of that withdrawal agreement, includes Gibraltar as part of the member state, the withdrawing member state, the United Kingdom. And that, Mr. Speaker, the legal position is clear. It is also true, Mr. Speaker, and he will be aware, that there is a concordat signed after I agreed it with the former Prime Minister Theresa May at Downing Street, between me and the then Deputy Prime Minister, the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Mr. Third, now David Livingston, which sets out how the responsibilities under the MOU are to be attributed given the constitutional rights and obligations of the different parties, namely the United Kingdom and Gibraltar. And then, Speaker, he can have the assurances from me that Gibraltar will always insist that anybody who properly characterizes what is happening understands it in keeping with the United Kingdom law, Gibraltar law, and the withdrawal agreement, and the agreement entered into between the United Kingdom and Gibraltar, and therefore cannot characterize anything that is going on as being bilateral between the United Kingdom and Spain. Speaker, we talked about the withdrawal agreement. Of course, the withdrawal agreement is bilateral in one sense. At least, you know, bilateral between the Union and the UK. The protocol annexed to the withdrawal agreement is subject, it's part and parcel of an agreement which is bilateral between the European Union and the UK. The Chief Minister makes reference to the Cordoba Agreement, not being agreements and so on, but in some way what? Seeking to suggest what exactly that there we could take comfort or in the fact that they weren't agreements, because I think a lot of members in this house, probably all of us, share the view that other political agreements. They're not legal agreements, they're not legally enforceable, they're a legal agreement, they're just legal agreements. Those were at the same presumably safety, but were objectionable to the people who voted. They were still objectionable, and it seems to know that. So, yes, I get the distinction between political and legally enforceable, but there are agreements that can still be of a different status, they are objectionable, and indeed, I suggest to the Honourable Member that we need to be careful where, in the same way that he says caution to members of the House and people out there generally, don't assume that there is bilateralism just because people say that it's bilateral or give the tone of bilateralism. Honourable Members should not assume there is bilateralism just because someone may mention that it is bilateral, because if I've come across press articles in Spain where they refer to Gestapo even though they are talked under the Lisbon Agreement, which plainly was not bilateral in nature. So what I'm seeking to urge the Honourable Member is that he be mindful of sections and form, and that he protects Gibraltar in the negotiations in relation to all the factors. I have no doubt that he has, in those negotiations, he goes into those negotiations with good faith, seeking to protect Gibraltar. And when we were on the other side, when I was a minister on the other side, it took us a long time to sit down with Spain at talk. And the reason for that was because structure and form was so important to us when we were on the other side of of this house, and I ask him to have been mindful and to give assurances on that issue.
Mr. Speaker, I can give those assurances.
Of course I can give assurances.
And indeed, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman has followed the debate. He will know that even in the context of the presentation to the Spanish media, the decision of the Spanish cabinet 3 weeks ago, that the tax treaty was going to the Cortes for approval, the minister, the spokesperson minister of the Spanish government said clearly, the arrangement with Gibraltar, because that's what they are. In her interview with Radio Nacional de España on Brexit Day on the 31st of January, Mr. Speaker, the new Spanish foreign minister said, we are going to sit down at the table, at the negotiating table, with the authorities in Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker. So I think it's very clear that everybody understands that Gibraltar is not going to accept anything which is in any way going to affect our ability to have a separate voice and to have a veto over anything that applies to Gibraltar being agreed. So that, and in my mind, is slipping any of the other ingredients of the trilateral forum. But I must correct him when he says that when he was in government, they didn't sit down with the Spaniards to talk, and it took them some time. Unless they were talking to the Spaniards before joint sovereignty, and they haven't told us, the trilateral forum didn't happen until he was leaving or about to lead another party and had left the executive of the GOP. So I don't know of a period between 1996 and 2003, when he was in government, of them talking to the Spanish in the context of formal talks. But if he does know, I'm sure the House would be delighted to have that historical fact set out. Mr. Speaker, everyone can be confident that the government of Ireland is not going to compromise one iota when it comes either to Gibraltar being able to represent itself and being recognized to represent itself, or on the substance of the issue of sovereignty or anything else which is either commercially important or important in respect of jurisdiction or control. Everybody has that assurance. People understand that the government of Ireland is not up for any discussion that might compromise any of those issues, let alone the substance of any agreement compromising any of those issues.
Mr. Speaker, certainly was not suggesting we were talking to Spain at 10 times before John Sovereignty or when I was a minister. And I said, well, it took us a long time. It did. It took us in the GSP a long time to sit down with Spain in talk. And I was still a member of the executive because the trilateral commenced in 2004. The trilateral process, the body of agreement, and that culminated in 2006, but there was another matter. And the fact that I left the party and then came back here, and went because he left the party of the member that sits on his right, and even though he's not here today, and joined the party of the member that sits on his left, the Hawk of Hawks, because it was convenient, politically expedient to him to do so, because he didn't have the guts to go and run with another political party. I told him that before. Every time he's rude, I can be rude back. But we can play this game all day long, Mr. Speaker. But, Mr. Speaker, on the last question, which is the issue on the Schengen zone, the common travel area, we know what he says, and I'm grateful for his explanation. In some quarters, it was considered to be somewhat of a surprise. And I'm only staring at the headline of a popular Gibraltar baby that called it the Gabbard Singham Bombshell, and bemoaned the fact that people in Gibraltar seem to find out about these things after the Spanish or foreign press. Will the Chief Minister give assurances that even though he doesn't give us the detail of it, that he will keep it, he will give us a bit of
formed than the foreign threat.
And the honourable gentleman does not stop to surprise me and other members of the House. He now considers rude a reminder of the fact of history. I don't consider it rude for him to say that I moved from the Liberal Party, in which I was a member with him and with the honourable gentleman sitting to his right, to the GSLP. I don't consider it rude at all. I mean, the characterization that I did it because I don't have a job might be considered by some with thinner skin as being rude. But I obviously did it because I'm a stronger politician than him, and I got to the chair that he wants to and he's been able to. And the first step, Mr. Speaker. Because at least I didn't have to compromise my principles when I did that, because by then the party to my left, the leader of the party to my left, had done an agreement with the leader of the party to my right some years before, and they were already defending a joint manifesto. So I don't see why I should be for one moment concerned about that, Mr. Speaker. They're defending a joint manifesto, which means they're defending the same principles, which means you don't have to compromise your principles to make the move. But of course, I understand that this hurts them, Mr. Speaker, because having moved four times from political stable, from the National Party to the GSP, from the GSP to the PDP, and from the PDP back to the GSP, he has a thinner skin than most when it comes to these issues. And of course, in that context, Mr. Speaker, in that context, when those parties are fighting elections against each other, you've got to have a strong definition of principle to try and protect the others who are bending. But I don't regard it as rude at all. I'm not for one moment think that, Mr. Speaker. I regard it as quite entertaining to see him twist in the wind. But he won't have a problem with me. What he wants to have is a debate about the history of our respective political leaders. I've always went in one direction, and he's went left, he's went right, he's went left, he's went right. He reminds me of the honourable gentleman, Mr. Speaker, who I always regard as a soldier of Gibraltar politics, because I see Mr. Beaton sometimes marching politically, left, right, which is when they would try to bend at any particular time. But despite that, Mr. Speaker, I'm surprised that he's trying to gain some kudos for having been involved in the trilateral assessment for the Speaker. The things that he said about the trilateral process and the Cordoba Agreement, which I have had cause to read recently, can best be regarded as rude about the people he now shares a bench with and the way that they defended those arrangements. Indeed, it was a very entertaining exchange in one of the local dailies between the former member of the GSLP, then member of the Labour Party, and leader of the Labour Party, then member of the GSD, who was deemed by some not to be of GSD stock and therefore led to some leaving the GSD, having left previously the National Party to form the PDP, which was progressive, to come back to the Christian Democratic GSD, which is very entertaining indeed. One was defending the airport agreement, saying it was fantastic, and the other one was saying it was the greatest treachery since history was invented. So, history, Mr. Speaker, as he knows, is always going to treat us better than him because it's going to be written by the Deputy Chief Minister of the only foreign in the South. But when it comes, I think we're journalists. Oh, I see. Okay. Whereas one tries to paint the picture of what's happening in Gibraltar as artistically as possible, I hope the Honourable Lady will also see it as well. But Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman, in relying on another newspaper to say that somehow people have been surprised by what he characterized, or he said that he said characterized as the things in Bonsall, would be failing to bring his own forensic skills to the analysis of the Schengen debate. Because if he's relying on that publication for that particular article, he would be forgetting to analyze the statements he had made repeatedly on this subject, starting with the visit to Gibraltar by Danny Alexander, or Mr. Alexander, as a member of the Liberal Conservative government in the United Kingdom. I think he was a Czech Secretary for the Treasury, came to Gibraltar. I had cause to say then that Gibraltar should consider the possibility of accessing Schengen,
and indeed consider our position in the Common Customs Union. And that was supported, as you will have heard me say before, but he appears to have forgotten, referring to the publication he's referring to, that Steve Lamonson, who is then responsible for immigration in the European Union, has supported the fact that the project could explore the possibility, and that subsequently the Minister for Europe, then David Livingstone, now Sir David Livingstone, had also supported the possibility of the exploration of Gibraltar's inclusion in Schengen. That is some 5 or 6 years ago. So much of a bombshell, Mr. Speaker. So, the Honourable Gentleman will allow me to say that I think he needs to brush up a little on his history, and that when he does, and he brings the facts to the House, I won't regard any of what he says as rude, as long as he doesn't refer to my entrails.
Question number 212, the Honourable Chair of the Party.
Mr. Speaker, what non-contractual controls are in place to supervise, monitor, and assess the performance and ensure that public contracts are fairly priced and that the risk of abuses are minimized and dealt with when identified? Mr. Speaker, the government introduced the purchasing and procurement policy on the 28th of March last year. This is a government-wide policy which lays out policies, procedures, and an ethical code when dealing with suppliers to be adopted by government organizations when sourcing goods, services, and or work. In this respect, the Digital Transformation Program introduces sourcing, ordering, and payment platforms which also affect procurement. These platforms, together with robust reporting tools and audit trails, simplify and provide a greater level of supervision and monitoring of government spending on procurement. The rollout of these platforms is currently underway. Any spend below government tender thresholds must be in accordance with the purchasing and procurement policy. Below tender threshold sourcing is limited to suppliers who have achieved the status of preferred supplier on government supplier network portal and determined using a price-only criteria. But purchasing and procurement policy, and in particular the new procedure for below tender sourcing, is increasing competition and transparency of government spend and allowing the market to price itself. Is that policy, the purchasing procurement policy, does it also impact on subcontracts entered into by public contractors? I don't think that there are any public contractors other than the ones that I referred to. But what I mean is, the Honourable Member perhaps not understood my question, is this control. Non-contractual controls on the pricing of public contracts. Once there is a contract in place, if there is any degree of subcontracting, does it impact on other rules that also affect that department?
But the speaker, this system ensures that the price that we obtain is checked against every other price on the market.
And in that way, must be affecting the pricing of subcontracts because the government is getting the best price for the taxpayer. Other controls still into the pricing through to the subcontractor. I don't think there ever has been, and I think it would be very difficult to reliably have any such mechanism in place.
Speaker, is this purchasing procurement policy contained in some kind of document or rule that the members of the court could give us a copy of?
Firstly, and secondly, who precisely has the duty to supervise this policy? You may have said it in his principal answer, but he was giving quite a lot of information.
These matters are run by the government procurement department. But they're run electronically now, you see the point.
That they're run on the basis of having to have the information inputted into the portal. And therefore, what comes out of the portal is assessed as being on a price basis, that's why I said the price only basis, the best price for a 500 HP pencil, for example.
In respect to my question as to whether it is a written document, does he know that?
Mr. Speaker, I don't know that. I don't want to assume anything. I believe that there will be something that can be extracted in writing. But I don't know that it has been circulated as a memorandum. Can I ask the Honourable Member perhaps to inquire whether there is such a document, and if so, perhaps you could give us an interest in it. If he wants us to ask the question specifically again, we can just to remind him of that. We are happy for the Honourable Gentleman to either write me or to ask the question again. And this is the successor and title, so to speak, of the policy that we have shared with the House before, which set out the criteria for procurement and how it had to be done. And because it's now being done electronically, it's done through this portal. That's why I'm telling him I don't know whether this has been circulated as a document as it used to be before, which he wouldn't ask me about, but if he asks me next time, if he writes to me, I'll let him have I'll extract the substance of it and either read it to the House or let him have a copy of it. And just finally, in terms of, if I understand it correctly, that the pricing is done on a sort of filling in this form of sort of electronic portal on a sort of self-referral basis into those. I'm not sure how best to talk about the description of it. But what happens next, there may be an adjudication of the contract, but in terms of actual performance, does the government procurement unit then go out on the ground and have discussions with contractors as necessary? Mr. Speaker, the way that the system works, and which I think I've explained, if you want to be on the portal, you have to be licensed with your trade license as you go into the portal, and you need to maintain that up to date, otherwise the portal rejects you. You need to be up to date with your tax and social insurance contributions, and if you don't, the portal rejects you and rejects your contribution. You have to be registered with the Department of Employment and Gibraltar. If your registration is active, the portal rejects you. So this is all done now, and I hesitate to call it AI, but it's done electronically. If your registration fails, you're not able to provide the quote. You're able to go into the platform to provide the quote. And then the quotes are assessed on the basis of the price to market. In other words, which is the cheapest of what we are being offered to ensure that people are not able to favour one or another on the basis of knowing who might be making a particular offer and are making the best choice. I hope that explains the way the system works and why I think the question he's asked doesn't go to the way that this system ensures that we're getting the best value for the taxpayer in respect of the procurement that we're doing. I think I'm grateful for that. But those mechanics, as I understand it, what he's indicated is there are a number of hurdles at which to put it briefly, computer can say no, and reject you from your application. But if you are then adjudicated the contract for baked beans to the government, for example, what I was really asking is, who then assures, not just that the price of the baked beans is the best possible, but that actually the baked beans have good quality. And forget about quality of course, does the procurement unit then subsequently, after an adjudication, is there any kind of monitoring of quality and performance in that way?
From the perspective of the procurement unit, it would be the place where those who enjoy the benefits of the procurement would go to complain if the quality was not what they were expecting. So they don't expect those in procurement to try the beans. But those who have the beans would come to procurement to tell them that they are not of the required quality.
Do all of that helps them to understand the price of eggs?
Well, big beans in this case.
From that, I take it that the Honourable Member is saying to his house, am I right, that in fact there is no quality assurance mechanism other than informal reporting to those who adjudicated the price of the piece of the things.
quite the opposite, Mr. Speaker. I don't know whether he's understood what I've explained, because I think it would be quite tempting for somebody who is not an expert in the things procured to be the filter of quality. So, if the person at procurement was asked to procure a thing, like, for example, food to be used in our hospitals or our elderly residential services, and he's required to fix it, then he might be the wrong filter. Well, the best filter, the most appropriate way to ensure that we're getting the quality, is to have a direct contact through to those who take the benefit of the procurement, so that they don't do anything informally. They actually consume, and if the consumption of the commodity which has been procured is not to the standard required, it can be stopped immediately by formally advising procurement to stop the procurement of that commodity from that entity, person or company, because it's not up to the required standard. I would think that is the best possible case. In other words, giving those of our citizens or civil servants who have to use the thing procured the ability to determine that what is being procured for them has or does not have the quality that is required. Because otherwise, Mr. Speaker, we would be putting in place a system that would not be producing what the citizens or the civil servants who have to use the things that are procured would have any feedback on, and I would regard that as not being satisfactory.
Question number 213, the Honourable Kenneth Fowley.
Speaker, when will the opposition be consulted on the draft nuclear information document to be sent in by the referendum administrator to persons eligible to vote in the forthcoming referendum on the 19th of March
2020?
Speaker, I would like to question 214217.
Question number 214, the Honourable Kenneth Fowley.
Mr. Speaker, when will the motion proposing the draft nuclear information document be sent from the referendum administrator to persons eligible to vote in the forthcoming referendum on 19th March 2023 presented?
Question number 215, the Honourable Kenneth Fowley.
Why would the opposition not consulted on the draft of the Crimes Amendment Act referendum regulations 2020, introduced on the 7th of February 2020 for the purpose of the forthcoming abortion law referendum on 19th March 2020?
Question number 216, the Honourable Kenneth Fowley.
Are any other rules or subsidiary legislation envisaged for introduction under the Referendum Act or any other act? The purposes of the forthcoming abortion law referendum on 19th March 2020.
Question number 217, the Honourable Kenneth Fowley.
Will the opposition be consulted on any other rules or subsidiary legislation that may need to be introduced under the Referendum Act for the purposes of the forthcoming abortion law referendum on 19th March 2020?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member obviously has already been sent a draft of the document by the Referendum Administrator for his comments, I understand. At this point, we know that the motion proposing the approval of the said nuclear information document is on the order paper for consideration at this meeting of Parliament. Given the time constraint, it is not possible to consult Honourable Members on rules for the referendum, and neither did the rules go beyond what was debated during the discussion of the earlier motion on the subject in this House. It is not envisaged that any other legislation will be necessary, and that there will be no need to consult any further. As far as I'm concerned, Mr. Speaker, the important thing now is for people to register to vote, if they've not done so already, to go out to vote on the day, and to vote yes to protect the rights of women. Mr. Speaker, we have been consulted on the draft mutual information document, indeed. And I wonder whether the tingling of our question prompted that on the Saturday after the Friday I received the mutual draft information document to be in the draft. But that leader, as we know, has been, we have received the document, And indeed, we note that the motion will be taken in this
And note also that what the Chief Minister said about consultation on the rule, it was our understanding, I have to say, that there would be some consultation on the rules. The motion had been presented by consensus. There had been a degree of conviviality, to use the Chief Minister's word that he has used from time to time in the better moments in the past, at that time. I certainly won't be drawn when we are discussing these questions, or indeed, hopefully, when we are adopting a more neutral and fair tone, which is, I think, the purpose of the neutral information document, as to how people should vote. And we'll no doubt express our views on this side of the House in due course. But it was our understanding that there would be consultation. It would have been, does the Honourable Member agree with me that it would have been better for there to be a bit of consultation on the rules, and that indeed, as a matter of practice, when there are rules that are contemplated in respect of elections or referenda, there should be such consultation of members of office. Indeed, there was consultation before the last election when there were rules that were contemplated for the introduction of profitability, for example. So, does the Honourable Member agree that it's not a principle really we should avoid, that there should be rules introduced by regulation in respect of referenda and indeed elections? Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member is absolutely right that it was a question that prompted that he should present the information document on a Saturday. I had, of course, in mind that the House would have the neutral information document in order to be able to debate the motion, but given that he asked on the Friday and I knew the House was meeting this week, there's no reason why I couldn't ask that he should have it that day, so we had the benefit of the weekend to consult it rather than during the course of the week. As I would have been happy with the Speaker to spend time consulting with him on the issue of the rules. But the rules, unfortunately, took time to draft. I wasn't able to look at them before, and we were running out of the time set out in the legislation to publish them. And they did only the things that we had debated during the course of the first convivial motion on the subject. The things that should be in rules that we had agreed should be in rules were put in rules. And there are indeed a carbon copy almost of the rules that he reminds us there was consultation on before the general election on those issues. So, Mr. Speaker, yes, I wish we had more time to consult with him on these dry legal issues, but no, I don't think that anything has turned on it. Mr. Speaker, the other gentleman refers to the special times in this House being convivial. Well, I don't think there's been any bad times in this House since he's been elected. And if you want to see what a bad time in this House looks like, it needs to go back to the day when some of us were called unfit to govern, and transcripts of Facebook videos were referred to as grubby publications, etc. None of that, Mr. Speaker, on my rather lighter watch than the sort of things that he might have seen before, Mr. Speaker, in this House. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, I haven't heard the Imperial March for ages, even on the Honourable Member's phone. Mr. Speaker, as to the clarity, the government, of course, in the course of the debate on the motion that I brought to determine the neutral information document, will seek to ensure that the House is satisfied that the neutral information document is neutral. But my position as Chief Minister, I have expressed repeatedly, and I will continue to express, and I will express it during the course of these debates or not, as may be appropriate. Because the debate doesn't have to be neutral. It is the conclusion that we reach as an information that we send to all voters that has to be neutral.
Question number 218, the Honourable Kenneth Bagan.
Speaker, does the government have any say in which subcontractors are engaged by TWS on the monitoring of such contracts?
I think for the Honourable Chief Minister.
Speaker, we answer with 219 and 220.
Question number 219, the Honourable Ms. Kandini Hassanon.
Why is TJBS a government owned company terminating the employment contract for workers in subcontracting firms?
Question number 220, the Honourable Ms. Kandini Hassanon.
Can government confirm how many workers have lost their jobs as a result of TJBS terminating contracts with subcontractors?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, TJBS has acted commercially at arm's length and independently since its inception and has not had any political involvement since its commencement of operations, at least while we have been in office. The government is not able to provide any information on workers who have lost their jobs with subcontractors or being told that they have lost their jobs with subcontractors as a result of TJBS workstreams coming to an end with any degree of accuracy. Honourable Lady should have a note that no one has alleged that TJBS has terminated any contract with subcontractors. What has been referred to is that contracts have come to an end, not that they have been terminated. There has been no termination of a contract that is on foot. Can I just ask on the question that I put, the Honourable Member, I think when he used the phrase that there hasn't been any political involvement, must have been addressing the question that I put. I wasn't suggesting that there was political involvement. What I'm saying is, what I was asking about is there some kind of rule to which that perhaps have been put in place? TJBS, a wholly owned government company, does it have to adhere to certain rules in the adjudication of subcontracts by it? That's really what I was proposing. And if so, what are the rules that it can adhere to, or is it free to the operatives of TJBS to subcontract without reference to governmental control? I wasn't talking about political control, some kind of procurement office, the kind of influence. That's really what I was asking. I see, Mr. Speaker, I mean, what led me to think he was asking about political interference was the word, does the government have any say in it? And that suggested that. But, Mr. Speaker, is that what he is asking is actually now more serious about, given his supplementary, then I can tell him that we ensure that all government entities, even if they are independent, are subject to the same government rules. And so, therefore, the rules on procurement that would apply to us apply to them. They have to follow, in the context of this sort of services, the three-part system. Those they contract with have to be approved government contractors, registered for with the ECB, registered with POA and social insurance, up to date in respect of all of those, etc. And then just putting that word, so, and therefore also subject to review and supervision by the same people. Is that right? No, speaker of supervision is done by the management team at JBS. So, in terms of adjudication of the subcontract, we've got to comply with the same rules as the government has for itself, but in terms of the supervision, the takedowns are there, that's left to them. There is no value for money supervision by the government itself. That's not what I said, Mr. Speaker. This is something we need to, I think, better understand. If JBS, or indeed another contracting entity, another entity contracted the government to do something for the government, and they want to subcontract, then our rules say you must subcontract only those who the government would be prepared to contract with.
we must do so in the way the government has contracted with them to ensure that is the money. That is to say, we must obtain through quotes, we must show if the, and this is under a particular threshold, as one of the governments has been told. If it's above that threshold, it will be the best of those three quotes. And then, Mr. Speaker, what there is, in terms of a control, is a control of the price being charged to the government by JBS or by any other entity. And that control is exercised by the chief technical officer and those who work with the chief technical officer who have supervision of all those contracts for the government, almost on a QS basis, and the QSs that may be there also for either DJBS or any other company that we have contracted with, that have to QS their subcontractors also in order to bring in the contract to the price agreed with the government.
Mr. Speaker, thank you to the Chief Minister for his answers. I appreciate the substance of what he said, and that perhaps my wording should have been more about non-re-engagement rather than termination. And if he would allow me to go with that, I could still ask him, given that the JBS is a government-owned company, even though there's been no re-engagement for these subcontracted firms, what type of responsibility anyway would the government take, considering, you know, we're going to have redundancies or job losses? And I know that the government is often very proud of the low rate of unemployment in the workforce, so obviously this is going to cause a surge in unemployment. How does the government deal with that? And also, what does it actually imply in the whole, in general, that a government-owned company is not re-engaging subcontractors? What does it mean? Does it mean that construction is sinking, there's no need? Or also, there's a lot of talk that I've had subcontractors coming to me telling me that there's been a delay in getting paid in payments if the company in financial difficulty, which may be leading to such a lack of re-engagement. Can the Chief Minister give us some light on all these factors which appear to be shrinking in terms of the company?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I want to be careful in the way that I answer the energy rate. There is no issue, financial issue, afflicting the ability of the JBS to pay. There are always issues between companies when it comes to payment, in particular at the end of construction contracts. This is now my third term as Chief Minister. I don't say that just for the sake of closing. The Honourable Gentleman will suggest I am. But simply because I've lived through this process now on a number of occasions. So I have answered a very similar question to members of the Spanish media recently who have thought that Brexit somehow is affecting the number of people who are contracted in our market as cross-frontier workers. There is no such effect, Mr. Speaker. What is happening, as much as we saw in 2011, and we saw in 2015, and we're now seeing again, is that we come to the end of an electoral cycle. We therefore come to the end of those of us who don't have coronavirus thinking that we have an obligation to deliver what we say in our manifestos we're going to deliver. When we've done that, or got as close to that as possible before a general election, the contracts are completed. There is a new manifesto. Those of us who don't regard it as a witness, they have to start the process of delivering against that manifesto. That manifesto is when you win the election, if you've done it properly, I mean, in some instances, in 2011, we found government plans were in the GST manifesto. So you could have gone from the John McIntosh Hall to the Chief Technical Officer the next morning and said, carry on. That is different. The plans in our manifesto are the plans of the political party. They become the plans of the government the morning that we are sworn in. Those plans then have to be given to the civil servants and said, this is the mandate of the people. And we have a hiatus, Mr. Speaker, in that process where projects are finishing or finished, people are moving on to do the subcontractors think they want to do other work. And then when the government companies are ready to develop the new project, there is a re-engagement or new contract
which we need to be offered against him. We saw it in 2011 to 2012, and then we saw it in 2015 and 16, and now we're simply seeing it again. It's the up and down of the construction industry. So, as the new government program starts to take off, you'll see many companies in Gibraltar, JBS is one because the government owns the third, and it tends to have a lot of the government work, starting new projects, and you'll start to see people engage once again as subcontractors, and in some instances, those subcontractors will have more work and will engage other workers. So, this is a pendulum that we have seen moving in the context of completion of government contracts and the restart of government projects on a parliament to parliament basis now, I think, for generations in Gibraltar. So that's really no need to have those concerns. The Honourable Lady will know that we have information from the Honourable Minister for Housing that we're now almost complete on the sales in the Central Community Territories. I told the House that we have commenced the work down at the Eastern Beach Reclamation, or the East Side Reclamation, in respect of the Central Community Territories. That, the House knows, was adjudicated through the site. So they've started work. There's the adjudication of two other housing projects, Stockton Commune and Chatham View, to come as well, which will give rise to more people having to be employed. There are schools to be built. There's a magnificent manifesto to deliver before the next general election. I think, Mr. Speaker, there should be absolutely no difficulty whatsoever. But because we come to the end of the contract, there's an adjustment then for payments in respect of things that may be disputed or not disputed, and there's also something called a retention. At the end of any construction period, the principal contractor will suffer something from the contracting party, usually in the context of these government projects, the government, which is known as a retention, and the principal contractor will also inflict that retention against its subcontractors, and that retention is to ensure quality of work, etc. It's usually about 10% at the end of the contract, and it's not paid for a period of 12 to 24 months, depending on the contractual arrangements that have been done. And I don't know whether that is the issue that has been perhaps misinterpreted by some to do some issues with the financial health of the JBS. I can tell something to the Honourable Lady, which might be helpful, if you like, and so everyone can hear it. The government of Gibraltar, I've said it before, other two ministers have said it before, the government of Gibraltar will always stand behind the government of Gibraltar company. So there's no question, even if the government of Gibraltar company didn't have money, that the government of Gibraltar would allow it to fall because it would affect the credibility and credit readiness of the government of Gibraltar. So that is not in any way an issue. Full stop.
We now return to question 193. The questioner is the Honourable Aaron Kenton.
Can we advise the individual level gross borrowing from Battery Bank PLC and Royal Bank of Scotland International Limited, trading as NatWest International, respectively as at 31st October 2019?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and Logistics.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer the question to the level of questions 194 and 195.
Question 194, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can we get to advise that it intends to refinance the £50 million Barclays facility that matures on 29th of June 2020 by causing the savings bank to purchase new government debentures?
Question 195, the Honourable Ian Clinton.
Speaker, can the government explain why Royal Bank of Scotland's International Limited made it a condition precedent that all existing borrowing has to be repaid, as per Schedule 1 clause 3.1, in respect of the entering into force of the £25 million credit facility dated 10th October 2019?
I am for the Honourable Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and Logistics.
Mr. Speaker, the gross borrowing as of the 31st of October 2019 was £50 million from Barclays Bank and £75 million from NatWest International.
It is intended to refinance the £50 million facility in June 2020, as a system on the surface of refinance would be taken near the date. The answer to the question on the decisions taken by the Royal Bank of Scotland International Limited is no. I'm speaking to the Minister for example. Given that the maturing Barclays facility of $100 million wasn't renewed at Barclays and they are simply coming up, and that NatWest made a very condition precedent that existing borrowing, i.e., the existing $50 million facility, would be repaid before lending $25 million, would the Minister agree with me that NatWest total appetite for Gibraltar is $25 million and that is unlikely to renew the $50 million? Would the Minister agree with me with that analysis?
Well, my understanding is in fact that the terms on which Barclays Bank was willing to renew the $50 million were not acceptable to the government, because we could get better terms than the ones they were offering. So it's not the case that they were, that they had no appetite. Their appetite came at a price that we were not prepared to pay. That's my understanding of the data. That is what it is today. As far as that was, you know, it was the view in the treasury that it was preferable to have one loan agreement with $75 million than allow the existing one to continue and take another new one for 25.
I'm going to continue with an answer. I'm going to start one last question related to 194. And I imagine I can get the answer, but it is confirmed to have that from his point of view, he would have no problem with the savings bank taking on the $50 million government debt if Barclays were not willing to renew, or there was no other force to renew to replace it.
I said before, Mr. Speaker, that if it was my decision, it would be done by the savings bank.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House is now adjourned to tomorrow at 3:30 p.m. I now propose a question, which is that this House is now adjourned to Friday the 21st of February at 3:30 p.m. And I put the question, which is that this House is now adjourned to Friday the 21st of February at 3:30. Those in favour? Against? The House will now adjourn to Friday 21st of February at 3:30 p.m.